Without beard or a team of reindeer. So if you can figure that out, I don't know if this one's going to let me play or not. I'm going to be angry. Okay, let's go to page 39. And then we will ask the typical questions, and then we will... We are on, you'd ask me, the 23rd of Sivan. Okay, Gibret Sheba.
I just like the whole story about, and then how the one part about maybe casting the lemon into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
It almost reminds me of our, what's the story of the tea?
Tea party?
Yeah, the tea
Boston
party.
Boston tea party.
Boston, but I just thought it was amazing because when I started reading the story, I started thinking, man, this sounds like Pixar. And sure enough, so that was just, it was really cool.
Yeah, very good. One of the things we're trying not to do, because things are being changed around, you could see this, no, you could see it from this one. I gave a hint this week, and I'm doing this right. On page 41. Where I inserted as a Gemara to 1 Peter 22 through 25, the section of Timothy, 3:8 through 16, and three of the paragraphs that would break into the Gemara for Hakam Spetz Peter. And so what that actually is for everyone a sneak peek of the future.
Okay.
Because... Acts will actually be tied directly to Genesis. Then Romans will be to Exodus. Leviticus will take these pastorals, Timothy, etc. And then James will take the book of Devarim or Deuteronomy. And when you look at the paragraph breaks, which is the way we determine how these things work. This is a part of what the verbal tally is for, but the verbal tally gives us connections, vocabulary connections across the board between the different pieces of text, but when we look at the paragraph, we'll talk about this more in a minute, but when we look at the paragraph is in some way related to the related Torah Seder'im. And we'll explain all that a little bit more in a minute. Okay? With Adasa, Mother, you have a...
I particularly like the part, it just helped me understand the oral Torah
Second Peter.
Just right across the page.
Yeah, okay, very good.
Yeah. I hadn't really put it together before, I guess. But it's like, oh, okay. But it really enlightened me on the oral Torah, the importance of the oral Torah.
Okay. The oral Torah, by and large, is a body of material that accompanies the Torah, the written Torah. But what you must realize, and I usually go back to Genesis chapter 3 for this, but I will press on, 3 and 8. Where that Adam and Chava are in the garden, and they've committed treason, if you will, against the commandments of God. And it says that the voice of God was walking in the garden. Voices don't walk.
Sure.
And So what should be evident is that the oral Torah is how God created the world. Now, when I translate, as you all well know, the second chapter of Acts, and when I translate Exodus 19:16, I say that in that section it says there when they go to receive the Torah, so there were voices. It does not say there was one voice. Now, sages will say that the voice was God speaking in the 72 different languages of the dialects of the earth. And I have taken pieces of the Midrash Rabbah and the Gemara and put them and wove them all together. And I have a section where that I say that the voices are the Torah teachers. So when you hear the voices, if I say Ahakam, what you must understand is, yeah, that word is a sage, but everyone who teaches Torah in a measure is a hacham. So what you hear is the Torah teachers is they're going back and forth teaching the Torah. So the oral Torah stands in its own entirety and does not really need the written Torah. But the way that Raphael Simchon Hirsch says that the written Torah is like the notes that a student would have while he was studying the oral Torah. So the oral Torah is very, very, very important. Now, for us as Nazareans, what is most important about the oral Torah is the way that Yeshua interpreted it. Okay? So that we must keep in mind and we must learn several things out of it. Dr. Connie, would you like to make any statements? Yes, no? You're just here for the audience? Okay. Okay. Anybody on the internet wish to interject anything right now? You found a bunny.
Bunny. In the, I was looking at the complete Jewish Bible and reading this version. And I was, let's see, I believe it's Luke.
You have 10?
Uh-huh. Yeah, 10, 3 through 6. And it says, if your version is, I believe it's a part of which do not move from house to house.
Yeah.
No, it's is it remain in the house? Maybe it is. Do not move from house to house. Anyway, they said don't schmooze with just anybody. That must be Yiddish, right?
It is. Schmooze is like having a joyful conversation, some of it not so important conversation. Schmoozing, just having idle chatter. Very good, very good. Anybody else have anything to interject?
Yes, Your Eminence. At the bottom of page 40, the last two lines, it's talking about those who swim, those who floated on planks, and those who took anything from the ship.
Uh-huh.
I was sitting thinking about that today. And those swimming, is that those that are, after a period of learning and observing mitzvot, who are integrated into the community?
Absolutely.
Maybe, I guess, some are learning or just beginning to mitzvot?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's very good. Very good. And of course, you understand that Jews and the entire history, they hate water. Okay? So, you know, every time they come to a body of water, you know, it's like either they split the water or the water rolls back or whatever. And I even heard a story that one guy hated it so much he just walked across it.
Boy, you were really an alien.
He did good, didn't he?
Hey, and when we go to the Dead Sea to go fishing, we always get a taker. There's only one fish there, and he's dead. It's the Dead Sea. Okay, you can see what we did, and you have talked about this with His Eminence. I'm not going to try to rehearse his words. On page 40, and then seeing the rudimentary hermeneutics of how to interpret the Nazarene code cell. His Eminence and I were talking just a few minutes ago, and in thinking about this, I had thought about the history, Christian history, and we'll talk about Jewish history in a minute, but in Christian history, there was a period of time when the Bible was chained to the pulpit. Now, my question to you, is that a bad thing or a good thing?
If it's chained and not any, just anybody can read it.
Okay. Anybody on the internet?
Yes, how about both?
That's what I said, yes.
She said, Gerrit Sheva said yes. Yeah, both is right. Why? Because what that did is keep people from that didn't understand how to deal with the languages and situations, etc. It kept them from trying to interpret it in their own way. However, what this turns out to be is an opportunity to make people do whatever they want because you interpret the scriptures how you want. But you could see that it could be a positive thing if it was done correctly. And that those who would interpret it just at their own whim would make it say whatever they wanted it to say. Unfortunately, the most lucrative business in the world is not drugs. It's selling Bibles. And if you have some well-known pastor, and I don't care what congregation or what faith, etc., one of the fastest ways to sell more Bibles is to say this guy helped translate this, or he built these notes, or he did whatever. And they'll put it out in somebody's name, and when they put it out in somebody's name, then you think that, this person wrote this, and then it also gives them seeming amount of legitimacy to the text. So it becomes just another profitable process. So selling Bibles is, again, it's very, very lucrative. And the problem is that people read the text and they don't understand the process of hermeneutic that is taken to scale through the words and the meanings and the associations of the text, and then they come up with their own version, and then of course you have chaos. So, what I want to do is, I laid this out, but you all have been through this with His Eminence. And what I did, the reason I gave you the Gemara to Hakam Safet, Peter 1:22-25, is so that you can look at each of those three specific paragraphs, and then you can go through the six hermeneutic questions and see if you cannot unravel what is being said and the association being connected to our piece of Hakam Safet this week. So you have now until Thursday to do that. And then Thursday, Friday morning, you'll have a new tour set. You already have a new tour set, but you understand. Okay? So I'm not going to spend a lot of time dealing with that. I want to go through something that I've gone through in the past, but it's been a long time, and I'm not sure if those of you from Texas have heard me speak on this, and I'm not sure if Givret Sheba or Givret Hadassah have heard me speak about this. I'm not sure if Dr. Connie has heard me speak about this. But I want to show you the way that the Nazarene Codicil was actually written. And most of us see these paragraphs and they're totally disassociated with the Torah. And so we don't really know wholeheartedly what they mean. And because the Nazarene Codicil is the forerunner to the system of the Mishnah and Gemara, then if we understand how the Mishnah and the Gemara work, then we can have insights into the Nazarene Codicil and see how it actually works and its structure and its function, and look at it almost as if it were a skyscraper being built somewhere in a big city. So the first thing that you have to take into consideration, supposing that you are an individual, one of Messiah's students, and he has given you the assignment to build a, we will call it a commentary, although it will not be a commentary. It will be a structure of halacha, but it's easiest, I guess, to say that it's a structure of halacha, okay? So, what is redundantly used is Yeshua's idea of the Shema, right? So if he says that the Shema is the most important of all the mitzvot, then you understand that you want to know the proper way to deal with, to read, to recite, etc., the Shema. In order to do that, you have to go to the Oral Torah. But obviously, you go to the Oral Torah, but where did the command come from in the beginning? Or where did it originate? It originated, of course, in the Torah. Right? So it says in Deuteronomy, hear, O Israel. And so there's a commandment to recite that. And there are many particulars around that, but that can serve as a fundamental for understanding that the Nazarene Codicil is primarily halachic. But it's the halacha of the Messiah. And it happens to be Jewish halacha as well, but it's the halacha for certain, it's the halacha of Messiah. So, number one, let's suppose that the Master is giving you the job of writing the paragraph of the Nazarene Codicil for this week's Torah Seder. Everybody with me? You got your imaginary cap on? And So imagine that Yeshua has come to you and said, I want you this week to write a paragraph that will connect all of this material together. Where do you start? No ideas. You need to know the Torah portion. Okay? So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to read the Torah portion. And you're going to reread the Torah portion and reread the Torah portion. Because what you're looking for, and I hate to use this word, but I'll use it anyway and you will understand. But you're looking for the messianic characteristics of the text. Okay, so the text, the pieces of the text that will relate to Messiah, his job, his activities, etc. And so you've been in school with him now for 3.5 years. And he has, over this 3.5 year period, gone through 156 to 157 Torah Sederim. But he's gone through more than that because there are other things to deal with, which we'll talk about in a minute, okay? So, the first thing you do is you read the Torah portion, okay? And then, as His Eminence has done for the last two Sundays, he asked you about how you saw Messiah in those texts. This being the situation, you know, you start looking for the text, and one of the other pieces of material that you will use, so you can use this as an addendum to your Torah study, and that would be, what addendum do you have? It's laid out for you in our Torah Seder. Our Torah Seder is laid out exactly the way you need it to do what Chacham Sofer and Chacham Shaul and everyone did. You will have the prophetic writings, absolutely, and we'll get to that in a minute, but something before that. Say it again. The Ketuvim. Well, that will come first before the prophets. You are correct. But there's something that if you go to page, I don't care what page.
The commentary.
Not the commentary. No. We're commanded to also today read the Targum. That's why there's a Targum in it. Do you have an art scroll? Did anybody have an art scroll? Chumash? No. Not with you, huh? Okay. Why the Targum? Say it again.
Because it's messianic.
It's very messianic. But it's almost like a commentary translation. Okay? So, whenever, especially being messianic, and you know, there are obviously key Hebrew or in this case Aramaic words that are very, very important, and you've seen them, Mimra, etc. So, whenever you read Mimra, you know that there's some form of connection to Messiah. Okay, now we use the Yonatan, the Pseudo Yonatan, but there's the Somsino and the Art Scroll use Ankelos, and both of those, the interesting thing about both of them is that they're supposed to be really Peshat, and I have a big problem with that.
Yeah, I don't think they're Peshat.
You know, when we start alluding to Messiah by using the word Mimra, all of a sudden we're not in Peshat anymore. Okay? But nevertheless, okay, so number one, you need what? You need the Torah, and you need to know where we are in the Torah portion. You need to know, literally, you need to know the Torah, and we'll discuss this more in a minute, but first you would need the Torah. So you need to be aware of the Torah reading for that week, and you need to be well versed in it, and what you're looking for is every little minuscule relationship to Messiah. As I said Sunday morning, the sages say in Tractate Sanhedrin 98a and 98b, I believe it is, and 99a, that every verse of the Torah in some way is about Messiah. So, that being said, how many of you can take, and didn't matter where we're at in the Torah, you can stop and say, well, this is Messiah right here, and unfold Messiah, the Messianic mission, etc., all of that out of just that single verse. And this is what I also said Sunday morning in Luke 24, where it says they were on the road to Emmaus, and it says Yeshua starts with the Torah and with the prophets, and he explains how all of these things have to happen to Messiah. And they said, didn't our hearts burn? So that is another way of saying that not only was he showing Torah to them and explaining Messiah to them, he was explaining Messiah to them in a way that made it unbelievably real to them. They could see that passage literally as a messianic explanation for everything that Yeshua himself did. Now, I'm sure that he did not 100% explain, obviously, every minute point that was to be made, but you well understand. So, let's just ask the question here. Okay, so they're on the road to Emmaus. This is south of Jerusalem. I guess it's a little southwest of Jerusalem, 6-7 miles. And so he is speaking to them, and they're receiving his divine revelation, and it's burning within their hearts. It would be quite interesting to know those people exactly how they lived and felt and etc., because then we would see the Torah as it applied to them. Okay, so let's take that as the first thing. So first thing on your bulleted list is going to be the Torah, right? You're going to have to know and understand the Torah. Now, let me say something that we all make a mistake with. It's not really ironed down so much in our group, perhaps the way that it should be, but we do not use, technically, in the 3.5-year schedule, the septennial cycle, 2 3.5-year cycles, the true phrase should be the Torah Seder. Not the Torah portion or a Parsha, etc. It's a Seder, and I will explain that in a minute. Okay? So number one, we have the Torah. Number two, we have a Targum that we need to read, because it's going to give us further insight into Messianic references in the Torah. Okay? What else do we need? Then we need the Psalms. What did David say about it? Why is it so important to understand what David said about it? Well, he was a king. That's one.
Okay, I'm going to go out.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm Wait. No, I was going to go out on a limb and say he was a Gilgal of the Messiah.
He was the prototype of Messiah.
Prototype, okay.
Okay? So, even though the rabbis take and point out Messiah in many different places out of the Tanakh, the Torah, the writings, etc., the importance of Davidic work was so powerful that they begin to attribute all messianic ideas with David. And David being the prototype for Messiah, it is often said that the case would be is that David would come back. And he would be Messiah. Now, you shouldn't find any significant troubles out of those things, because I think I said it Sunday morning, but the point is that the spirit of Messiah is similar to Adam HaRishon. Now, this is like having the cart before the horse, saying it like this, but this will have to suffice. Number one, David is the prototype of Messiah, but the spirit of Messiah, like Adam HaRishon, the first man, is so big that it stretches from the earth to the heavens. Now, it said when Adam HaRishon, the first man, was created, his head was in the heavens and his feet were on the earth. And then when he sins, he's tied to, if you will, he's tied to the earth. And he does not have that stature anymore. But with Adam Chadmon, the prototypical man, the man after which all of mankind is patterned, that aspect is truly Messiah, and it reaches into the highest of the heavens and into the, excuse me, the lowest depths of the earth. Okay? So, David can be Messiah, and his son Shlomo, Solomon, can be a Messiah at the same time. And I think I quoted Sunday morning that Abraham comes to Melchizedek. Melchizedek is some refer to him as. And you had two prototypes or two pictures of Messiah at one time. Both of them endowed with the spirit of Messiah. That's because the spirit of Messiah is big enough for the whole work, and was the first thought of God when he started and when he initiated creation. When God decided to create, his first thought was Messiah. This, it says in Zohar. Okay, so number one, we have the Torah. Number two, we have the Targum. Number three, we have the Psalms. And then we have, obviously, the Hashlamatot, and the importance of the prophets and their writings. Now, you all understand that the writings of the prophets are at minimum remes. Right? So you need to think when you read the prophets in allegory. If you're thinking in literality, for example, there was a place where the head of an axe comes off and it falls into the water. And then they are praying and all of a sudden the iron starts to float. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to say God can't do that, because I know He can. But that's not the point. If we just resign it to being a miracle, then, you know, it's just a miracle, and it's lost its importance, its remnant's importance. So when we read the prophets have things to say, but they say them at minimum in allegory, and when they say them in allegory, then you're forced to a place of having to think about what the text means. Okay, you think if we open up to the book of Ezekiel and start reading the first chapter that we should read everything in Peshat? So, you know, I saw this bright flashing light. I've seen that before too. Usually when I'm doing 56.
Those are blue.
Blue flashing lights. The floor is blue. The floor of the throne room is blue. You think there's no flashing lights there?
I think it's the same.
Okay. So let's build our list. Number one, we have the Torah. Number two, we have the Targum. Number three, we have the Psalms. Number four, we have the prophets. You with me? Okay, so armed with this data, we can begin to interpret a piece of text for finding a messianic understanding. Oh, wait, I forgot something. What else do we need?
Verbal tallies.
Verbal tallies, very good. So whatever key words are in the Torah, we need to weave those words into our commentary. Okay, so you're taking, for example, now we have about five things. And the five things that we have at present, you sit down with a piece of paper, and you can put 1 through 5, and then you read the Torah, and you make some ideas, you make some thoughts on the Torah. Then you read the Targum, then you read the Psalms, and then you read the prophets. And you look at the verbal connections between the Torah, the Psalms, the prophets, and it is... It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen with the Targum unless you learn another process. What would that process be? You need to read Aramaic, but you need to be able to do what? If you're reading and writing in Hebrew and you're going to write a Hebrew commentary, you need what? You need to be able to do a cross-linguistic communication here, because you need to know that the word memra is the same word as dabar, which is the same in Greek as logos. Okay, so you need to be able to understand these verbal connections and verbal similarities between the languages. So, for example, this is part of the situation we have now for doing the Nazarene Codicil, right? The verbal tally is not just to fill up paper. I know you know this, I'm just suggesting, but... The verbal tally is because there is a translation of the Torah, the Tanakh, in Greek. And it's very important when you want to start translating vocabulary in the Nazarene Codicil. But there's a big, big problem with that. And that is... Then Nazarene Codicil was not written in classical Greek. It was written in Koine Greek. Now, I have some ideas that are contrary to what a lot of the scholars say. I say it wasn't Koine Greek. It was a Hebraized Greek. They call it a dirty Greek, a street Greek. When you start reading the Nazarene Codex, so you can read words and you know that the words that are coming, some of them are Greek and some of them are Hebraized, etc. But it's not a system whereby the Hebrew language is absolutely forfeited. But the real problem is that there are two versions of Greek. Even though the Septuagint is still also a Hebraized Greek, it's an older Greek, and the so-called Koine Greek is a newer Greek. You start to have places where that the Septuagint does not have words that the Nazarene Code still does. And this is especially true if you read the writings of Hacham Shaul. You talk about a guy that wants to invent language. He invents words that are not words. And he'll compound a word with two different words that is not a word. Okay? So you need the ability to look at the verbal tallies. But not only do you need a verbal tally, you need a crossed linguistic hermeneutic. Lingua. Okay?
Cross-linguistic
hermeneutic. Okay, in other words, you need to know if this word, debar, means the word, thing, it, blah, blah, blah. Then when you read logos, it means that. And so when you read logos in the Greek, you can say this is related to the Hebrew debar or the Aramaic memra. And it's very interesting because the word memra is much more associated with Messiah than the word debar is. But that's just use. Simple use. Okay. So, Torah, Targum, Psalms, Prophets, Verbal Tallies, Cross-Linguistic Hermeneutics. Have we covered everything that we need to write our Nazarene Codex? Need a good rabbi? No, Yeshua came to you and said, I want you to do it. What would it look like?
Elementary,
Michael
Watson, exactly what mine would look like.
Mine wouldn't even be elementary. Okay. You need to know something else that's very important. Otherwise, you will miss the whole point. What month are we in right now in the Hebrew month?
Sivan.
What happened on Sivan the 6th? Sivan the 6th was when we received the Torah. We went to the Har Sinai. And we received the Torah there. So what would happen if Yeshua came to you and it was on Sivan the 6th and said, I want you to write the commentary for the week? You have to know something about the festivals. And you have to know exactly where we're at on the calendar. Because certain times of the year, certain aspects shift the Torah portion itself into neutral and they play on the calendar and the festivals. And there's a time of the year when it's told that you're supposed to remember the Amalek. So on that particular Shabbat, what do? You don't read the Torah Seder that week. You read on the story of destruction of the Amalek. Everybody is going to be able to write next week's Nazarene code cell. Have we covered everything? I got 7 things here. Number 1, Torah. Number 2, the Targum. Number 3, the Psalms. The Prophets. Verbal tallies. Cross linguistics. And the calendar, which is including all the festivals. What are we going to read about this coming Shabbat? Anybody have a clue? New moon. Rosh Chodesh. Huh?
I thought we just said
that. No. Well, we didn't. It didn't fall out for Sivan. It didn't fall out exactly on the month. This week it will. Okay? So it's Rosh Chodesh. And this is still part of the calendar. Knowing where we're at on the calendar. Okay? Anything else you can think of?
Wouldn't we need to know an incident that Yeshua did on this certain time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what you want to know most of all, is what he did. Now, His Eminence calls this Hakam Safet's Big Book. Okay? But I'm going to give you a key here that is hard to handle. The narrative is not the message. The narrative is the carrier of the message. So you just read this piece of Hakam Shaul's Remez, and you read about boards floating in the sea, and you read about the wheat that's thrown into the sea, and you read about all these different things. He doesn't care if you think that was a real story or not. He doesn't care. Why? Because he's speaking in Remez terms, and he wants you to pick up on the allegory of the situation and see how that alludes to the fact that he kept Pesach. What else happened on that boat in this particular Torah or this particular section? They ran the boat aground. Is that not semi-associated with the idea that the sea parted and they walked across on? So who cares if they threw all this stuff in the sea and blah, 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 blah. If you work for the CIA and you read the newspaper about something and then you went to the boss and said, look, right here, it's right here, black and white, see it? They're going to do this. It is for some guy that's an analyst for the CIA or whoever. He doesn't care what the story said. He's looking at all the codifications behind the text. And to masterfully use the right words to tell the right story an allegory? You know, Hakamsho was sitting in the boat. He has a sack lunch, brown paper bag. He's writing his commentary on the back of the paper sack. Okay? Let's see if we can go down this list. Number one, the Torah. Number two, we said the Targum. Number three, we said the Psalms. Number four, we said the prophets. Number five, verbal tallies, cross-linguistic. We need to know the calendar festivals. We need to have an awareness of what Chacham Sofer has in that big book of his. That's all we need? So I can hand this particular piece of homework off to you right now. And next week you can write me a commentary, just a few couple of paragraphs, that will elucidate how Messiah relates to all these pieces in the Torah Sederim. Is there anything else that we've missed that we need to add to this list? I mean, we've simplified it pretty well. You have a bulleted list. You just have to follow this little bit of criteria. It shouldn't be too hard. Right? Okay, the one thing that we missed is that which level of hermeneutic does he want me to write on? Okay. So, I don't know about you. I give you an assignment to write a couple of paragraphs for Remez this week. Nazarene Remez. What do you need? What items do you need? Give me a list.
Leaving like a tin mug. Some paper, pen.
You'd be very, very realistic. A computer.
Rabbi Google.
You're going to get in trouble. His eminence doesn't like Rabbi Google. Okay, let's go down the list. Number one, you need to know the Torah portion. Number two, you need to read the Targum. Number three, you need the Psalms. Number four, you need the prophets. Number five, you need the verbal tallies. Six, you need cross-linguistics. Number seven is you need to understand the festivals of the calendar. You need to know, number eight, what was in that big book. And now you're writing on Remez. Then there's something else that you writing in Remez have to have. A glass of port.
A glass of what?
Port.
Wine.
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 Scotch. 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 Rum. What else do you need? You need another thing. What do you need?
What, towels?
Mm-hmm. using the Talmud would be very helpful because it could do what? It could show you structure, and you want to follow that structure. So when you get to the place of actually writing a remez, you truly need to understand Talmudic structure, Mishnaic Talmudic structure. And I just gave him the clue. You need somebody else to write the Peshat. Because you can't have a remez until you have a Peshat. So you need to say, Gered Sheva, you were in charge of writing Peshat this week. I need your translation and your little paracope. I need that so I can do my remez. And then there comes those verbal tallies again. There comes that cross-linguistic business again. Because the fascinating thing about what Hakam Sefet does is not only does Hakam Sefet lay down for the remez piece, if you will, of the text, he also lays for the Midrash, and he also lays for the Sa'odic piece. So if you want to study the Sa'od, you hang out with the guy that knows Peshat. Why? Because Peshat is a, if we could say it like this, a simplified version of Sa'od. It's got all the stuff there. I say it continuously. How come Hakam Yochanan and John was so successful at writing Sa'odic materials? Because he was always with Hakam Sefet, reading the book of Acts. Peter's going down to meet Cornelius, and he's going to bring a bunch of guys with him, and one of them happens to be a guy named John. It's not just the three Hakamim of Hakam Sefet, Hakam Yaakov, James, and Hakam Yochanan, John, who saw Yeshua transfigured, as it were, on the mountain. It's not just because they're the quintessential part of the Yeshua's Beit Din, but they hang out with one another because they understand how to communicate with one another, not just on simplistic levels, but on higher levels of communication. So you can have a group or a room full of students, and you can take 1 hour to try to explain one word. But if you have a student in that group that has already been through that hour lesson on that word, all you have to do is say the word. And he understands the whole process of what you're trying to convey. Hakam Sefet gave Hakam Shaul the greatest gift any rabbi could give another rabbi. What was that? A scribe. But a scribe that was trained in Peshat. He literally knew all of Hakam Sefet's literature. All of his teachings, everything that was in the book. He was what we call a Tana. A Tana is a walking tape recorder. You say Bereishit, and he can recite Bereishit backwards, forwards, upside down, no matter what. He can tell you the fifth word, seventh word. He can tell you everything about Bereishit that you want to know. But why did Hillel, or Luke, or Silas, he's known by many different names in the Nazarene Codicil. Why? Because he's the author of all these different books, but each one contains a different ideal. Why did Luke not want to stay with Hakam Sefet? Listen, Hakam Sefet, he was the man. He was the one closest to Yeshua. So if you want to be close to Yeshua, you want to be closest to the man who was closest to Yeshua. But Luke didn't want to stay with Hakam Tzafet. Why? He didn't like Peshat. He was Remez in his ideology, thinking, and process of hermeneutic, which fit Chacham Shaul perfectly. But he could turn to Luke and say, what does he say about this particular Torah portion? And he begins to rattle on and on and on, all the things that Chacham Tzafet taught. So if you are given the task of writing the remez, you need also the Peshat portion. Now we can take this further and apply it to Midrash and so on. Midrash is going to be key more and associated more with verbal tally, because Midrash is a very special vocabulary of its own, as it were, and it will always be associated with the idea of kingdom. Therefore, it will be very legal, but it will be parabolic, because what it's trying to do is give you the moral of the story. Right? That's the lesson in Midrash. You know, he could tell you about, there was this time when there were the 10 virgins, and they all went and they had their oil, but some of them didn't have oil to go through all the night. And so you started hearing all this story, and the moral of the story is, make sure you have enough oil to make through the night. Okay, now that's just in plain language, but there's plenty to dissect after that, right? And then, of course, the same is also very true of the text of Sa'od. And when you have Sa'od, you still start out with, it's very interesting, you see in Tosefta, and you see in Sa'odic material, and of course Peshat material, the very first pericope, or actually the last pericope, but the first pericope, the end is in the beginning, etc. You see the word Bereishit. All of them use Bereishit, but Matthew does not use the word Bereishit. But he uses a Bereishit idea, as in, this is the genealogy of Messiah. And still starting to say, this is the beginning of Messiah. This is the history of Messiah before there was a Messiah. Okay, let's go through the list. Number one, we have a Torah. Number two, we have a Targum. Number three, we have a Psalms. Number four, we have a Prophet. Number five, we have verbal tallies. Number six, we have cross-linguistic verbal connections. We need to know the calendar. We need to know what's in Chacham Tzafet's big book. And we need to know specifically what level of hermeneutic we're writing on. Do is conclude with this. Let's go to page 39. and you can take this list that I've given you. There are some other things we need to add to it, but we will not do that this evening. But what I'd like you to do is to look at Chacham Safed's writing here, 1 Peter 22 through 25. And basically, what you should do is try to break this down into three fundamental statements. Then, you should go to page 41. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Chacham Safed's writing there, his paragraphs. Break that down into three paragraphs. Then page 41, where it says Gemara to 1 Peter. This is the one that should actually take the place of Acts this week, where Acts is in here this week in the eventual scheme of things. We will have Timothy here, this piece of Timothy. What I would like you to try to do is to take these three paragraphs here of the Gemara to Peter, 1 Peter 22-25, and see if they don't line up with the three paragraphs that you have made. From the writing of Chacham Safed.